From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Maria Popova is the Internet's kid in a candy shop of the world's great intellectual traditions, a very precocious kid, a one-time Bulgarian bodybuilder who now mines great thinking at her popular website, Brain Pickings. She's picked out some particularly valuable thinking for us to consider at the beginning of this new year. From James Baldwin to Grace Paley to Martha Graham and beyond, this hour On Point, we're revving up the life of the mind for a new year with Maria Popova. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What, who gets your mind in gear for a new year, a new day? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Maria Popova, writer, blogger, critic, founder of Brain Pickings. It's a website on culture, books, and more. Her most recent essay there is 16 Elevating Resolutions for 2016, inspired by some of humanity's greatest minds. You can find a link at our website, onpointradio.org. Maria Popova, welcome to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Such a pleasure to be here, Tom.
It's just a delight. I am way too lucky to have this job. I've thought for such a long time how much fun it would be just to sit and talk with you, and now here we get to do it. Thank you for doing what you do every day. What kind of engine drives you? You never cease putting up wonderful new material. What's your fuel, Maria?
I would say my fuel is the same as everybody's fuel, which is this kind of hunger for meaning, and for a sense of belonging with a larger sense of human thought and human endeavor.
You've called Brain Pickings an inventory of ideas on what it means to live a life of meaning. There's so much that's been thought and written and passed down for so long, and yet it's so easy just to skip past it and miss it.
Indeed. And, you know, what's strange is that we have such a culture of I would say information fetishism, and we often tend to mistake information for meaning. And I think it's really rewarding to dive in and see what the sources of meaning are in the age of information.
I want to get in there with Rilke and Kierkegaard and the others on your list for starting off 2016. But I notice, and it's interesting because we go both ways here. We talk a lot about news, but we also talk a lot about ideas and insights from the sciences and the arts. You say that in many ways you are quite anti-news. What do you mean by that?
I mean that I think we live stretched between the temporal and the eternal, and we're constantly negotiating the two. We're so swept up in the vortex of immediacy and what is happening to us right now, what we're experiencing, what we're struggling with at this particular point in time. And the news is the machinery of that vortex. And in a way, even on a kind of in our personal lives, we feel that whatever we're experiencing right now is singular to us, is singular to the moment. But it never is. And everything we feel and experience has been felt and experienced by others over the millennia. And every once in a while, I think we catch a glimpse of that, of those abiding and universal struggles of the human experience, which both inform our own and are fed into by our own. And the anti-news aspect is really being present with this constant dynamic interaction between the now and the forever. And I think when we're able to engage in it, when we commit to engaging in it, we feel less alone, we feel more whole, we feel less stranded in time and experience.
I noticed again over the holidays we've just come through how sewn in to their digital devices so many people are today. It's kind of incredible. And that essentially means sewn into the Internet, about which you have some ambivalence, despite the fact that you're posting on the Internet every day. Brain Pickings is on the Internet, but there's some, you say the Internet may be self-perfecting organism, but self-perfecting for what interests or whose?
Well, I should clarify that I don't have any bias toward a technology or a medium. I'm more concerned about the ways we use them. So, for example, you know, somebody reading Aristotle on their Kindle, which is mm-hmm. in the public domain, doesn't make it any less valuable, any less intellectually rewarding than reading Aristotle in a print book.
Of course, yeah.
I completely don't believe that. But I think part of the structure of the internet is such that it prioritizes the more recent as the more important. I mean, if you think about how every news feed, even the notion of a feed, if you look at the On Point podcast feed on iTunes, for mm-hmm. instance, it's mm-hmm. ordered in reverse chronology, meaning the more recent episodes are at the top and the older ones sink toward the bottom. But if you listen to something from 2 years ago, a conversation that you had, or 2 months ago with Patti Smith, I loved that. It's not any less relevant today than it was 2 months ago. But the internet reinforces this illusion that what floats to the top of our Twitter feed, Facebook feed, news feed is the most urgent and most pertinent to what we call reality.
And it may or may not be. That's tied right in next to your wariness about the news. I mean, that is a line we have to ride all the time because we pay attention to news and we pay attention to much more. I read your sort of great thinkers for 2015, Seneca and Virginia Woolf and Alan Watts and Emerson and Bruce Lee and right on. You're out with a new list now, Maria, for 2016. And it's got just great material, themes, and people. I wonder how you sit down when you think about what to offer people to begin a new year to nourish the life of the mind. Is everything eternal verities, or are you trying to reach out for thinkers who may particularly speak to the challenges and dynamics of this moment, the beginning of this year?
Well, first of all, I don't sit down thinking what to offer people. I sit down thinking what to offer myself. And Brain Pickings, which is now in its 10th year, which I guess makes me an internet ancient.
Congratulations, I guess.
Thank you. But it's always been my record of my quest for meaning and my becoming. And it's really wonderful to hear when that resonates with other people, but it's always going to be a reflection of what I'm struggling with, what I'm hoping for. So in the 2016 one, it was very much things that have been on my mind that I worry about and I kind of aspire toward. But one good example, for instance, is on the list was James Baldwin. Mm-hmm. And last year, in maybe the beginning of the year, maybe shortly after Ferguson and all these things were going on, I noticed by almost serendipity, I was reading an out-of-print book by Margaret Mead, and there was a footnote there in which she pointed out that she had had a conversation with James Baldwin about race. And I thought, that would be very interesting to find. And I tracked down the book, also out of print, which is called A Rap on Race. And mm-hmm. it's a transcript of a conversation that they had in August of 1970.
A seven-hour conversation
two days, yeah. 2.5 days, which is even that in and of itself gives you pause in terms of where public discourse has gone today. Mm-hmm. We don't do that anymore. But in any case, reading that book, it was astonishing how much they're discussing issues that we're discussing today. And because of the modality of their conversation, they're discussing them with a lot more depth and mutual respect and just integrity. It's something different happens when you sit together for 7 hours and you reflect not just on the news point issue at hand, but on everything that systemically informs it underneath, millennia of mm-hmm. anthropology and geopolitical history and personal experience and all of that. And so I found that offering a portion of that for us to think about today very much informs the dialogue on those topics today and gives depth and dimension that are not necessarily present in the news aspect of how we talk about this today.
The great anthropologist, of course, Margaret Mead, talking with the great poet James Baldwin, African-American and with a very keen sense of identity. She had her anthropologist sense. His struck me as really the she's great, but his seemed more durable to me and really spoke to the moment all these decades later as Ferguson was exploding, all these ideas about identity exploding. You remind us of him, James Baldwin, talking about how much it takes to wrest identity out of nothing. And you quote him saying, you've got to tell the world how to treat you. If the world tells you how you are going to be treated, you are in trouble. You are in
mm-hmm.
trouble.
Yes.
The vulnerability that we experience without the, I guess in some ways, armor or a substance of a strong identity that we project. Baldwin pointing straight at there.
Well, and another aspect of that is actually, I think, perhaps qualitatively different today than it was in 1970 is that more and more, I mean, one thing that happens, I think, with complexity being the nature of the universe, is that it is constantly increasing and evolving into more chaos. And we as humans are sense-making creatures. We try to make sense of complexity. But past a certain point, we have certain cognitive limits. There is such a thing as too much. And the way that we deal is by imposing these artificial subunits of simplicity on things that are overwhelming. Now, identity is a very complex thing. Mm-hmm. And when we can't parse it out, when we can't process it in ourselves or others, we pick one dimension, one variable that we can process and say, this person is this or this or this. And it's usually a variable that's based on difference and exclusion. So how much more different from us are they along a specific simple dimension? And of course, the trouble is that identity is complex. We're a lot of things all at once. And wresting identity out of nothing is less hard in a way than wresting an identity out of everything.
I suppose who would know that better than a poet? And a poet as great as James Baldwin. But even there, he says, out of all that welter, you'd better come up with a message to the world about yourself, however you conceive your identity, about how you will be treated, or the world will decide. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking this hour at thinking big, thinking deeply to kick off 2016 with some elevated resolutions for the new year from Maria Popova, writer, blogger, critic, author of the web's Brain Pickings, where the good, deep thinking of humanity never dies. She brings it up and back and makes it relevant again and again. Joins us today from New York. She's got 16 big thinkers with 16 big ideas. We're going to dive right in, and you can join us as well. Do you follow Maria Popova? Are you hungry for more than listicles and cat pictures? Is there something about the internet that draws us to the momentary, the fleeting? And how do you keep the bigger picture in mind as you move through life, start a new year? Just a quick side before we dive in. Here's one of our listeners online, Shabby, says, because of her history, yours, native of Bulgaria, and your status as internet sensation, what might Popova say about the status or importance or relevance of locality in the internet age? What makes a location and locale relevant with the internet, which conveys this illusion that ubiquity is possible or advantageous? You came up out of Bulgaria, you're in New York, what's locale matter?
Well, it's a really, really good question with so many layers to it. I will say in one way it matters not at all, and in another way it matters enormously. And what I mean is sometimes an outside perspective is really a wonderful beginner's mind of sorts. So I came to the U.S. when I was in my late teens. I came for college, and I came with this enormous sense of cultural debt. Like, I didn't know all of these things that Americans did know, that I was discovering, you know, Susan Sontag for the first time, assuming everybody else knew every word she'd ever written. And after a while, because you have no sense of what the common baseline level of knowledge and awareness is, you end up diving much deeper in some areas than the average person might in a culture that is native to them. But you bring kind of the local sense of externality to it that powers the deeper internal diving in a way, if that makes any sense. And interestingly, I am very much, as much as I may publish on the internet, I am very much an embodied creature. I'm a creature in three-dimensional space. You know, I love moving around the city and looking up and looking at the world. And I also am very strongly bound to my local community of close humans. But what's interesting is that these two forces in my experience, have been in dialogue always. And all the people in my life who are important to me, who are my, you know, a lot of us who have had challenging childhoods perhaps would relate to this notion of creating a makeshift family in adulthood. And all of my makeshift family is very locally based. They're friends, people that I've encountered through my work who have become family.
That keeps it local, and it's a good place to dive into your list of elevating resolutions for 2016. You start right off with the great poet Adrienne Rich, and the resolution you draw from her and her work is sounds grand, but it is as straightforward for meaning as anything I know. It is cultivate honorable relationships. What does she mean by that? What does she say?
So Adrienne Rich is probably best known as a poet, but I'm a huge fan of her prose writing, which is very political and also very personal. And in one of the essays that she wrote in the 70s, she says, "An honorable human relationship, that is one in which two people have the right to use the word love, is a process, delicate, violent, often terrifying to both persons involved, a process of refining the truths they can tell each other." And I love that on so many levels. Yes.
She goes on, you quote her, says, "It's important to do this because it breaks down human self-delusion and isolation, that complete honesty in an honorable relationship."
Mm-hmm. And I think the truth aspect is what's really rich because we often throw facts at each other in a way of keeping from the truths, which are always vulnerable and vulnerable-making.
It's such a great resolution to start any year with, but it's a tall challenge. I mean, it can take time and such a generosity of heart and mind to get to a relationship like that, where you've got that full candor, where you're willing to be exposed as you search for that truth.
Mm. Well, at the end of that, she says, "It is important to do this because we can count on so few people to go that hard way with us." And I think that's absolutely true. And the investment of time and energy and love that we put into the people who are willing and the people we are willing to go with is one of the most rewarding things in life.
Elevating resolution number one there from Adrienne Rich, cultivate honorable relationships. We're talking with Maria Popova. She puts brain pickings together, brings us great thinkers every day. Stan's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Stan, you're on with Maria in New York.
Hi, Tom. I was 23 in 1970. I was working at the local newspaper. I had been involved with civil rights as a very young, very well-meaning young white guy from about 1962, trying to be involved in a town where we didn't have the kind of strong movie-style racism that you saw in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But we had it. And Baldwin was a major part of our consciousness from very early on. I think I read The Fire Next Time in high school, but that was up through 64. But I wanted to mention that Baldwin was an essayist and a novelist more than he was a poet.
True.
In the public mind.
Mm-hmm.
At the time. And sometimes when people hear the word poet, they'll turn away from it thinking that the poetry may not be accessible to them, especially if it's from a while back, like nearly 50 years. His essays, his novels, were not only accessible, they were like an injection of a human being directly into your bloodstream.
Yeah.
And I didn't want people to turn away from that because of the identity as one thing or another. He was all of that.
Stan, that is great. Let me quote, if I may, Maria Popova quoting Baldwin here to make the point of just how direct and, as she says, how relevant. She quotes him saying, of course, this is years ago, saying, "The police in this country make no distinction between a Black Panther or a black lawyer or my brother or me. The cops aren't going to ask me my name before they pull the trigger." As famous as he was, he saw that issue so clearly, and it's become such a hot issue in this country recently. Nothing vague at all about that, Maria.
I want to add something to the poet issue, because I think Stan is right, that this is a sort of trigger word that may alienate people. But I feel very strongly that all of these thinkers, not just Baldwin, all of these thinkers that inform and enrich and inspire our worldview today were poets in the larger sense, in the metaphorical sense. They were poets of the human spirit. And I think it's really important to preserve that. When you look at something, I mean, whatever the medium of their work, you look at, say, you know, Oliver Sacks was a poet who just happened to be a neurologist. Patti Smith is a poet. She started out as an actual poet, and now she's a poet who happens to be a phenomenal musician and artist. And just, you know, Van Gogh was a poet who happened to be a painter. But it's really important, I think, to honor the poetic spirit and not to dismiss it as a form or a style or a sensibility, and to really engage with that.
We certainly do not hear, though I know what Stan means when he fears that happening when the word comes up, but full honor. You've got Kierkegaard saying, resist absent-minded busyness in the age of Twitter and so many distractions. We all understand that very well. You've got Rilke saying, talking about how great sadness can bring us closer to ourselves. Speak to that. I'm coming out of a year that had more than enough of that. What about that dynamic?
Well, me too, as it happens, confirming the point that I'm writing this to and for myself in a way. You know, I mean, Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet is one of the great works of philosophy in my book and that humanity has ever produced. And a lot of these letters, which are addressed to a 19-year-old aspiring poet that he corresponded with over the course of 4 years, they are full of so much truth and so much beauty. And for me, I read them the way that people read scripture. When I have a hard time with something, I go back to that book and something in it invariably speaks to the problem. The letter, the one that I quoted in the resolutions is actually another one about living the questions and kind of being at peace and welcoming uncertainty, but that very much has to do with the sadness aspect, which he addresses in another letter, and talks about how sadnesses crack open who we are and bring us closer to that, to all the things that we've always been avoiding and fearing. And by forcing a confrontation with the parts we fear, we become more whole in ourselves.
Forcing a confrontation with fear. Maria Popova is with us from New York. We have Maria calling from Walcott, Vermont. Maria in Vermont, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi.
First of all, I'd like to say that I'm a total Rilke junkie myself, so I can really understand that. I love Rilke. But I was curious, you know, in a country that seems to get progressively dumbed down, where Maria feels that her audience comes from? Do you have, like, a certain avatar or idea of who the person is you're writing to? Do you do it for yourself? And has that changed over time with any kind of audience input? Are you still kind of serving the same purposes as you were starting out, do you think?
I am not at all serving the same purposes because I am a very different person than I was 10 years ago. I was in my early 20s when I started Brain Pickings, and it's, as I said, it's always been this kind of record of my becoming and my priorities and aspirations and concerns as a person, as any person's, have evolved tremendously in the decade since I started. But I do still very much write for myself. It's interesting. The question of audience has always been very intriguing to me because after a while, it's hard to ignore the fact that there are a few million people out there every month who read this thing that I write from a very personal place in a way. And negotiating the awareness of audience is very hard sometimes in terms of staying focused on and staying kind of true to the personal driver beneath it. I have no sense of kind of demographic, psychographic data on them, because I don't look at statistics, I don't look at, you know, analytics and other things like this that a lot of, I guess, media organizations look at, because I don't, there is no use for that for me, but I do hear from people. So anecdotally, I have a sense. And I get letters from all kinds of people, a lot of, I would say, current and former educators, a lot of retired educators. And I don't know if this is something indicative of my audience or indicative of the kind of person who sends generous letters to begin with. But for me, it's very polarized in terms of hearing mostly from the very young and from the elderly. So I get letters from high school and college students, and I get letters from people over 70.
Do you buy or call Maria's sense, worry, characterization of a dumbed-down culture? Do you feel yourself fighting a culture of know-nothingness?
I don't. I don't. I absolutely don't. I am very... I'm very concerned about certain cynical interpretations that we take on, because cynicism is what our culture rewards. And what we attend to shapes what we believe to be true. And if we attend to the undeniable amount of cat listicles and tabloids and things that are that speak to our baser nature, then it's easy to mistake that for the norm. But I do think that most people are good and intelligent and have a longing for meaning that is not represented in those depictions of culture, but is very much valid and true.
Talk about Ursula Le Guin. She makes your list of elevating resolutions. And in her case, what you've pulled up for us is her admonition that we refuse to play the perfection game, striving for perfection. What's the pitfall there?
So this comes from Ursula K. Le Guin is best known as one of the finest science fiction, fantasy writers, I guess, of her time. But again, as with Audrine Rich, I really enjoy her prose. And there's a collection of essays of hers called The Wave in the Mind, which is one of my favorite books of all time. And it's titled after a Virginia Woolf sentiment about writing and consciousness being the wave in the mind. And in that collection, there is an essay called Dogs, Cats, and Dancers, Thoughts About Beauty. And it's kind of about beauty and the very punishing ideals that we have around beauty, which have to do with health and youth and leanness and all of that. But it's really about the larger question of what it is we value in people. And she has this way of flowing from the serious to the playful to the solemn to the profound in a way that is unlike anything else. And she's one of the writers that make me feel very self-conscious about excerpting and kind of pulling bits and pieces of something that in its fullness is just astonishing. So I really recommend the full essay for people to read.
The links are always there. I love the characterization here, writing about Ursula K. Le Guin. Perfectionism is our most compulsive way of keeping ourselves small, a kind of psycho-emotional contortionism that gives the illusion of reaching for greatness while constricting us into increasingly suffocating smallness. I guess that's your summary, or is that her?
No, that's me. That's okay, me writing about the reason why I'm interested in looking at perfectionism, and then I go on to quote from her essay.
Do you see us living in a world where people are binding themselves with perfectionism?
Binding is the perfect term. It makes you think of foot binding and
yes,
the ancient way of just the pain and the punishment of perfectionism, yes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at thinking big, thinking deeply to kick off 2016 with some elevated resolutions for the new year. From Maria Popova, she puts together brain pickings on the web. If you read it, you know what a rich source it is of reminders and signposts to great thinking from really all the ages that she corrals day after day for anyone and everyone who wants to dive in. She's put together 16 resolutions for 2016. I don't know if we're going to get to all of them here, but we'll get to enough and link to more at our website. She's with us from New York today, and you can join us as well. Who, what are the lights that guide you into a new year through life, relationships, change? And do you thirst for great thinking these days? Do you take the trouble to find it, read it? There's Susan Sontag, a constant touchstone for Maria Popova here, and Bertrand Russell, and Eric Fromm, and on and on, Simone Weil. You go to Anne Truitt and her kind of admonition to choose understanding over judgment. This one seems very, very relevant to me in this year of 2016, and very, very difficult. What's the message?
So this is from her diary, which is a masterwork of philosophy, and which my friend Danny Shapiro turned me on to, so I should give credit because the book has been transformative for me. And in this particular passage, she recounts as a child walking into a store and seeing a very fat man and judging that and making all kinds of assumptions about who he is and why he is the way that he is. And then as an adult, she revisits this memory and she writes this beautiful passage on how judgment and preconception are the greatest barriers to love, because the second we hold somebody by an ideal of who they should be, we no longer understand and no longer can care for who they are.
Would you read that? It's so great. I would love to hear the passage that you have there.
It begins, it says, "Unless we are very, very careful, we doom each other by holding on to images of one another based on preconceptions that are in turn based on indifference to what is other than ourselves. This indifference can be, in its extreme, a form of murder and seems to me a rather common phenomenon. We claim autonomy for ourselves and forget that in so doing we can fall into the tyranny of defining other people as we would like them to be." And she goes on.
She says the opposite of inattention, and that's a kind of inattention. The opposite of inattention is love, is the honoring of others in a way that grants them the grace of their own autonomy and allows mutual discovery. This is a this is such a challenge to the sort of polarized view of at least politics, if not more, that seems to surround us all the time now. I don't know if people are being scared away from extending this kind of understanding. Judgment seems a safer some days.
Well, it relates back to the Baldwin idea of identity. In his conversation with Mead, at another point that I haven't quoted today, he says the Northern identity is based on exclusion. And I find that to be so powerful, because today almost every forceful notion of identity is based on exclusion, how different somebody is from us and how much they don't belong with the usness of us. And that is what Anne Truitt is really touching on. This is the barrier to mutual discovery. This is the kind of inattention to the wholeness of who somebody is.
The choice of understanding over judgment. There's a great challenge to wrestle with in 2016. Alan in Orleans, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on with Maria Popova.
Yes, great show as always. I'm looking forward to reading your blogs. The question I have is about contemporary authors from Eastern Europe as well as classical authors. Most people in the West here have never heard of Lermontov or Gogol, and as far as modern writers, Victor Pelevin wrote a book called Homo Sapiens, which I found an interesting a novel about modern society and its flaws and our human character. Are you familiar with the book?
I am not.
Yeah, it's interesting. He writes about, it's in Russia, and sort of a little bit of the underside of, you know, drinking and taking mushrooms and living life sort of haphazardly and carefree. But the idea is that of accepting people with their flaws rather than this perfectionism that you're talking about, that in contemporary society, I find people want the perfect relationship and the perfect man or the perfect woman, so they exclude everybody and wind up, everybody's going to grow old and alone from this behavior. And what's your thought on that?
It's a beautiful message and a perfect message, and thank you for the recommendation. I'll be sure to find the novel. But it also relates so much to not just the forces in our kind of societal dynamics, but also the most intimate realm of human relationships, love, and the expectation of the perfect person ends up really selling us short of the beauty and possibility in imperfection. And culturally, too, you know, one thing that I observe a lot and worry about is we seem to have a kind of swelling intolerance for imperfection. And of course, that's what our humanity is. It's flawed and imperfect. And people are very quick, it seems to me today, to point the finger at what they consider to be, I guess, hypocrisy or some kind of conflicting thing in a person who is admired for something. So, for example, I've written a lot about Alan Watts, who's an amazing British philosopher, popularized Eastern thought in the West in the 1950s and 60s. And it's probably the reason why we have, you know, employee meditation programs at Google and a mm-hmm. yoga studio in every New York City block and in Lululemon, you know. Every once in a while, somebody would say, well, Alan Watts was an alcoholic and he died by, you know, his alcoholism, and therefore we should dismiss his wisdom and his teaching. And the same thing with Van Gogh, you know, who changed the course of art, whose letters are a masterwork of philosophy, and who died by his own hand in the hands of mental illness. And people say, well, there's nothing we can learn from him because he killed himself and he was unhappy and died. And I think, you know, perfection, the thing that perfection sells us short on is this idea that I think who we are, the measure of our character, is what we're able to accomplish, who we are able to be despite our flaws, not what we do because of them.
I love it. And I appreciate your call. What about the ambit of your interests when it comes to intellectual tradition? I began by saying, you know, singular, but I wonder, do you look east? How far east? What's the continent of thinkers that you attend to?
Oh, I really try not to impose any mm-hmm. Geographic, cultural, temporal boundaries on it. Of course, we're always very limited by our starting point, you know, but the wonderful thing about human knowledge and the internet and literature most of all is that it is, I mean, literature, I often say this, literature is the original internet, and every reference and every allusion in something that you're familiar with or you're becoming familiar with is essentially a hyperlink to another piece of thought by another thinker that is somewhat close to the one you're currently engaging with, but far enough to be new. And if you follow them far enough, you end up someplace completely different. And I can't tell you how many things and ideas and thinkers I've discovered through footnotes, through random passing mentions that have led me so far in time and space and culture in a way that I would have never discovered had I only stayed within my filter bubble. And I think what's a really important practice for us is to continually push ourselves further out of what we already know and believe and explore what else is out there and then pick and choose what resonates for us, what expands us, but not to impose any kind of artificial boundary on where that exploration should end.
Maria Popova quotes Grace Paley on the art of growing older, and of course, Martha Nussbaum on listening to our emotions. We'll look at more. Jonathan in Nashville. Jonathan, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Maria. I was calling. Well, let me start with a quote by Salvador Dali, who said, "Never fear perfection, for you'll never reach it." But I was calling because I read an essay by Nietzsche just before the holiday season called On the Uses and Disadvantages of History for Life. And he's admonishing German society of the time for German academic society for trying to apply the scientific method to history and really just flooding people's minds with too much information about the past. And it really rang true for me in today's day and age, just by just substituting the word information for history in his essay, that we are so flooded by information and we're taking in so much information that we're not actually using, that it's almost having a crippling effect on individuals, that they're not able to act, they're not able to live, they're not able to create, because there's so many different perspectives and they haven't drawn, as he says, a horizon around their field of knowledge.
Well, you've got the perfect target for that observation, Maria Popova. I mean, she who will follow a footnote to the ends of the earth, and the internet, of course, makes that possible. What about the downside? What about the infinitude of options and paths? And I don't know, Jonathan almost describes a potential paralysis there.
Well, I think what's interesting is our use of the word history in this example. History is only ever useful to the extent that it produces some kind of wisdom that informs the present and our aspirations and ideals and efforts toward the future. But wisdom and information are not the same thing. Information is essentially bits of information. You know, information comes in bits. They're these kind of fragmentary pieces of data about some aspect of the world. A higher order thing that is above information is knowledge, which has to do with how different bits of information relate to one another in a kind of framework of understanding. And even above that is wisdom, which is about, which has a kind of moral component. It's a framework of understanding the world, of knowledge about the world as it is, but also as it should be. And that's the moral aspect. And I think there is no such thing as oversaturation with wisdom. The breaking point is where we fail to transmute information into knowledge, into wisdom, and then it can become kind of pointless and overwhelming and really drowning out the moral aspect. But history, properly used, properly engaged with, is the material of wisdom, not of information.
Of course, what we bring to that engagement can be interesting. One of your elevating resolutions goes to Martha Nussbaum, of course, the great philosopher, who talks about heeding the intelligence of the emotions, where people may not look immediately for knowledge, even wisdom. But here's a great philosopher saying, pay attention to your emotions at a profound level. What's the message?
She talks about the emotions not being, and the book itself is titled after a Proust line, and it's called Upheavals of Thought. And Proust wrote, of course, about the emotions as geologic upheavals of thought. And she basically says the emotions are not just these instinctual, responsive powers. They're part of the reasoning of the creature itself, she says. But one of the most interesting parts in that book to me was where she talks about the question of neediness as a function of the emotions. And of course, that's a term that's loaded with so much negative judgment. We consider neediness to be a bad thing, a flaw, something we have shame in ourselves and we shun in others. But her point is that neediness is really an acknowledgement of our incompleteness. And unless we acknowledge our incompleteness, we can never connect with another person. We can never connect with ourselves or accept ourselves fully. And that in and of itself is a form of intelligence. It's not a kind of impulse that is vacant and harmful. It is a very essential part of our human intelligence.
One more call we have time for. Eleanor is calling. Hi, Eleanor. You're on the air with Maria Popova.
Maria, I'm just beside myself to meet you. I had your site sent to me by my son many years ago, and I really want to go back to your comment about the age range, because he was very young, and I am now 82, and I have loved your site. And I also want to tell you, I'm so glad to hear you. You are so much younger than I imagined you to be. It's just a lovely voice. Thank you.
Thank you, Eleanor. That is so generous. Thank you so much.
Eleanor, it's terrific. And please come back and talk to us some more, Eleanor. Wonderful to hear your beautiful voice as well. I know one of your themes, and we've only got a minute or so remaining here, but this is another thing we really try and embrace here. So you've been interested for a while in the relationship between cynicism and hope or sincerity. You're quite the anti-cynicism person. I'm very sympathetic with that. What's your rationale?
I think cynicism is the sewage of the soul. Cynicism, we live in a culture that rewards critical thinking, and I think critical thinking is absolutely essential. It's at the heart of the scientific method. It's at the heart of having discriminating taste and thought about what matters and why. But where it bleeds into cynicism is where there's a kind of resignation of saying things are as they are, everything is messed up, and there's nothing to be done. And the voluntary helplessness in that, to me, is heartbreaking. Hope is the counterpoint. Intelligent hope is the counterpoint. Hope with critical thinking is the only antidote to cynicism, and one we very much need.
I love it. On our first day on the air in 2016, we will walk away from all that and go toward the hope. Maria Popova, what a treat to talk with you today. We've put a link to the entire list of 16 elevating resolutions at our website, onpointradio.org. It will get you to Brain Pickings, which Maria Popova puts together every day. What a labor, what a beautiful thing. And thank you for sharing just a little bit of it with us today, Maria. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, and thank you for what you do. I'm an enormous fan of the show, so thank you so much.
Well, let's keep it all going. We wish you a great year. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. And thanks to Maria Popova. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.